Well, hello, fellow baseball nuts, and a big warm welcome to episode number 4 of the Johnny and Josh Show, in company with that chap who used to do some producing, whose name I fail to remember. Great to have you company. Thanks for joining us again, and thank you for being a part of the family here on the Johnny and Josh Show. JC, the weather is phenomenal in this part of the world. How's it over the pond?
It's fine over here, Gouldy, but the word on the street is that you've been playing another bat and ball sport today, and that you actually did all right on the stumps.
Yeah, we didn't win. This is, you will remember from our Channel 5 days, and once in one weekend every August, the iconic Riverbank Ramblers, possibly one of the greatest cricket teams in the history of the sport. Our motto: we may not be any good on the grass, but no one beats us in the tea room. We've got some substantial players in the girth department. And yeah, I did all right today. We lost, unfortunately, but I was run out by one of my best mates, Big Chris Sheesby, ran me out. Can you believe it? When I was on 43, I think I can believe
that you got run out, and the waffle's already out. So, well done.
Talking of the waffle, there he is.
Yes, sir, there we go. I am back, and I'm armed with another waffle, something, a very important prop within the show, and it's good to have you guys back again this week for this fourth episode of our podcast. But that's not all. There's actually more to this party than is anticipated.
It certainly is. And thank God we have got the waffle, because, ladies and gentlemen, it's long overdue. We had hoped to have him earlier, but he's such a busy man now. He's back! By popular demand, it's Big Davey Lengel.
Just let me slide in here, folks.
It's not just David Lengel; it's David Lengel and his mustache, which is sort of the second part of the team.
This is how I express myself during a global pandemic.
David, I've got to say, buddy, it's a tragedy that we are predominantly still an audio medium, because, I mean, you are looking, I'm not even sure, like Magnum P.I.'s dad, German porn star, take your pick. Looking amazing.
German porn star, I will take. Magnum P.I.'s dad, I'm not so sure about.
How are you, mate? You well?
I'm doing very well. It's great to see all of you again. It's first time on the air with all you folks since 2008, so a long time overdue, huh?
Dave, we wanted you back before, but you're so busy. What are you up to now?
Time is money, guys. Let's go.
And there's no money in this. There's nothing happening in that department.
True. Time was money. Now let's hang out.
So right now, because obviously we got Josh over in Denver, Colorado. You got Johnny and I here in the UK. But you seem to be in a nice log cabin somewhere, a la Bill Lee. Kind of thing.
Yeah.
I am in
Are you writing manifestos in that cabin?
Yes, I should be. Canaan, New York, which is about, I don't know, 140 miles north of New York City right now.
I mean, if the woodwork's anything to go by, it looks like you just joined us from the sauna. Is there a lot of naked people in the background that we can't see?
He had a schwitz.
That's a great idea. I would love to have a schwitz and do a podcast at the same time. That would be kind of like, you know,
that
the
podcast
best
is out
of all
there.
Time.
I'm sure that the schwitz podcast is a thing, I'm sure.
Baseball and a schwitz.
Now, this is a family show. Don't forget. Come on, guys. The thing is, we are now in episode 4, and we were going to trudge along with what the hell is going on in Major League Baseball this week.
Well, as we know, guys, the injury scenario is the big talking point of the week, Eric. But before we even get into that, we still got to talk about COVID. It's still a big, big story. And I think the latest numbers, JC, correct me if I'm wrong, the Cards have lost 8 players and haven't played since when? Early last week?
Yeah, and they're not expected to play again until at least the middle to the end of next week. Their break will be at least as long as the Marlins' break, and, you know, the Marlins lost 18 players. So this is a huge hiccup for Major League Baseball. A hiccup actually is an understatement. A huge concern and a huge obstacle moving forward with all teams playing, and it's one that we're going to have to watch closely to make sure that one team doesn't get sidelined. We've already discussed the fact that not every team is going to play the same number of games potentially, and the Cardinals will be really hard-pressed to meet the full 60-game season.
So I think we can safely say we're going to have a load of these sort of doubleheaders, 6-7-inning pitching games. We got a question of that in the mailbag. Stay with us for that. But let's just talk about the other big story regarding beyond COVID in terms of injuries. And it really is terrifying. Here's the stat, guys. 2020's total of 39 non-COVID-related pitcher IL stints since opening day is more than 50% higher than in any other previous period. And it gets worse on the 2020 tally of 30 pitcher arm injuries. That is 150% higher than the record in any previous innings opening stretch. So there is clearly an issue. Some big names, Miles Mikolas is one, Cole Hamels, Corey Kluber, Justin Verlander, Clayton Kershaw, both of them have had issues already in the opening weeks. There's some big, big names out there being impacted. And I suppose it's not that surprising when you've had a 3.5 month layoff. And they always talk about needing at least 5 or 6 weeks of spring training to get the arm ready, to get the muscles ready, which of course they did not have in this abbreviated season. The other big question as well is some of these pitchers, when they're in lockdown, did they have home gyms? Did they have throwing partners? All those issues, little or no access to their usual routines, uneven adherence to the execution of their workouts because they're not there with the club, with the coaches. And obviously far less competitive pitching situations. There's changes to their sleep routine. There's so many issues that this abbreviated season has created, all of which surely may be an explanation. But before I come get you boys in, I want to ask you this. There's also the question of which of the pitchers, we all assume they all took a professional attitude, but did they? Did some pitchers look at this, it's a bit of a vacation, perhaps didn't prepare as well as they should have done? And with that in as well, I should suggest that you've got to consider the mental impact this endemic's had. It may be that some of these physical issues are to do with the mental worry that everybody's had in terms of people losing their lives, the danger to elderly members of your family, etc. They always say your mental and your physical conditions are connected. So is that another reason? And the reason I mention all of these, JC, and I will get you in, I promise, is because at the end of the day, actually, most opening pitchers, most starters have had a lesser workload than is the norm. I'll give you the stats. Through the first 10 days since opening day, they averaged 5.2 innings pitched, 22.1 batters faced, and 86.8 pitches thrown. Whereas that compares to the normal average of only, to this season, they've only had 4.6 innings pitched, 19.4 batters faced, and 76.4 pitches thrown. So those numbers clearly clarify that the pressure they've been put on, the coaches have tried to allow for this situation and take the pressure off, and yet here we are with numbers where people are just dropping like flies. What's your thoughts, JC?
Okay, first of all, Goldie, you put the Gettysburg Address to shame there with a soliloquy long enough to be any Shakespearean
play. Thank you, Dave. Yeah.
But, wow. But,
I don't want anybody thinking I haven't done my preparation.
Beyond that, exactly. Goldie was prepared. Thumbs up. But beyond that, I want to push back on the idea that players weren't prepared. We always talk about major league pitchers, particularly as being thoroughbreds, and a lot of that is about process. And these players, year in, year out, know what the process is to prepare. And what's so telling about how this year is different and how the change because of COVID and because of the length of season has been the determining factor for these injuries is the fact that you look at names like Justin Verlander, Max Scherzer with a hamstring injury, Kershaw missed games, as you mentioned, with a back injury, Corey Kluber, Strasburg. These are all big names. These are guys who are pros, who know how to prepare when they're in a season that they know how to prepare for. This is completely different, and that's the reason why we're having the problem. We talk about the impact that COVID's going to have, certainly on the world tremendously, but on baseball moving forward. But I feel like there are going to be reverberations from this requirement of these players and pitchers to throw when they weren't ready for more time than we expect. They're players who are going under Tommy John surgery, and it's wrong. And David Price said it best when he said, Major League Baseball needs to have the players' interests in mind first. And this is a suggestion even beyond COVID that they did not.
It seems like they didn't. I mean, 3 weeks is clearly not enough. Johnny is actually asking for everybody to do free work when they're not being paid. I'm sure most of the pitchers were doing that free work while in quarantine, trying to keep up. And Josh, I think you'll remember that when summer camp broke, I think everybody was talking about how the pitchers were kind of ahead of the hitters, and the hitters are going to need more time, and they need to get their timing. And one thing we've learned more than ever is that baseball is such a sport of routine. You just never want to stop if you're a baseball player. I remember even going back to 2006, Johnny, when St. Louis and Detroit were playing the World Series, and Detroit had all that time off, and they came back, and everybody thought they'd be rested and it'd be great, but they couldn't hit. And it always seems to come back to pitchers needing to get their ligaments ready, to get their muscles ready, and there's a reason. That's everybody says, oh, spring training is so long. Why is it so long? Well, we're finding out right now why it's so long. They need this time to get in tune.
David, one of the reasons that people thought the pitchers were going to be ahead is that the season was starting in the warmer months. You weren't starting in April where it was still cold. Pitchers have a harder time getting ready. But that's, again, reflective of how damaging this short truncated period was for the pitchers, that they're still coming in a part of the season where they should be warm, where they should be looser, and they're still getting injured.
And now add Michael Walker to that list, Ozuna and Houston to that list. I think he might be getting
Ken Giles injured too. I mean, it's not just starters, you know, ace relief pitchers too.
It's a huge problem. And wouldn't you think, by the way, that since all this quality of pitching is going down, that it would affect how many runs are scored in a game? But actually, runs are down half a run. That's how we know that this game is just kind of in complete flux right now. The Orioles are 7-7 at this point, and all this pitching has gone down, and they're scoring less runs, and nothing adds up or makes sense.
But it does make sense in a way, in that all these star pitchers who really elevate certain teams are out. So all of a sudden, it brings them down to a different level with these other teams where maybe their mediocre pitching is sort of now on par with a team like the Astros, who have lost, I think, at least six pitchers
so many.
Their rotation and their total pitching staff.
They have a ton of rookies going right now, Houston.
On the final, going back to the COVID thing, it's just been announced by Major League Baseball that players boarding flights to go on road trips now have to wear surgical masks instead of cloth masks. Don't want to get in debate on which mask is better here on this show, but that's another.
So long.
Hey, buddy, that's bizarre because, as you guys know, I just flew back from France, and we were told that we had to have the surgical masks, and we wouldn't be allowed on the plane because we couldn't have these cloth masks.
Well, there you go.
So EasyJet,
Major League Baseball doing concessions, making sure that everything goes according to plan. And one more thing,
to the party.
Christian Yelich kind of wishes he was on the injured list because he's only batting 114 and needed a fluky inside the park home run today to break him out of his slump. Well, moving on, but of course,
it was.
Before we proceed with the festivities here, I got to do my trivia question off the top of the show. It's not the top of the show anymore, so let's continue here with Eric Stumper. Today's trivia question is, because the closing ceremonies of the 2020 Tokyo Olympics would have been just a few days ago, we didn't get to see any Olympic baseball this year. The last time any of us saw Olympic baseball was in 2008 when it was in Beijing. And since then, baseball has not been a part of the Olympic program nor considered an Olympic sport until Tokyo took it back. So my question to you guys is, the 2008 bronze medal winners in baseball were actually the United States. Not gold. The States actually only won bronze that year. Hey, they medaled at least. You know, they, let's give them some kudos. South Korea won the gold, beating Cuba, who got the silver. Now, my question is, which member of that bronze medal U.S. team went on to become a World Series MVP in Major League Baseball?
Ooh. Yeah.
Interesting.
There was one superstar. That was a college team, or maybe it was. There were some minor leaguers on it, but certainly not players on the 40-man. There was one player who was a real standout pitcher on that team, who was a college phenom.
Okay, well, it was a save for the fans. Okay. Let people cogitate over.
You know,
give him a second to think about it.
No, it's at the end of the show.
No, we do it at the end of the show. Don't you worry, Dave. We have time to cogitate.
Anyways,
I was worried I have to have an answer right now.
Moving on to the next topic. We are talking about those crazy Marlins. It's Marlins madness in Miami. And now we're going to get Josh to tell us all about it.
Yeah, well, David, you were right on point when you said this is one of the most topsy-turvy seasons ever, certainly in modern history, and no team reflects that more than the Miami Marlins. So between August 1st and August 6th, the Marlins made 36 transactions. 36. And keep in mind, they had the 18 players, as we mentioned, and three staff members who had COVID. So it's not surprising that they had to make changes. But whenever I think of this Marlins team, I think of that scene or the series of scenes in Major League where, like, they're calling Charlie Sheen at the California Penitentiary. He had played in the California Penal League. And the players coming from everywhere, that's how this team was put together. We're talking about seven players who had recently been waived, who had been released, or had come from indie ball teams. You have a player who is better known in 2014, Eddie Alvarez, for winning a silver medal in short track racing, ice,
speed skate
racer, speed skate. That's what they call it, with the longer skates.
Yeah,
I mean, it's unbelievable the team that they had to put together. And you expect when a team like that comes together, it's not going to be like Major League, right? The movie, because that's a movie. But it has been. They were 2-1 before their break, 8-game break, changed the roster almost more than half, and they go on a 5-game winning streak. It's just unbelievable.
And how about Don Mattingly, who gets the shaft in L.A. and has to come out and manage Jeter's team in Miami, and as if it hasn't been bad enough, he's got separate parts of his teams in different parts of the country. He's got guys in hotels in Philadelphia. He's got guys in Miami. He's got teams spread out all over the place. He's got speed skaters in the lineup. He didn't even know the names of some of the people who he was playing. He's like, and they have two guys named Josh Smith. Two players named Josh Smith, the same name.
A terrible name.
Guys, what amazes me.
Yeah, I wouldn't use Smith as a last name either, Eric.
But guys, what amazes me now how they've got is one, how well they've played since they started replaying.
It's
they're
incredible.
Top of the flipping National League East with a 7-2 record as we stand. And when you consider, it's not just the number of players they lost, but also the caliber. They lost their 1-2-3 in the rotation, and they lost 7 members of their bullpen. I mean, that sounds like my fantasy baseball pitching team. That should have been carnage. It should have been game over, and yet they're winning. It's like they're drawing inspiration from this nightmare scenario, and they're proving that actually dreams do come true, that miracles do happen. The miracle Miami Marlins.
But here's the drama, right? Is that you have those 18 players who were sidelined because of COVID. They will eventually come back. If this team keeps on playing well, how do you determine who gets back on the roster and who doesn't? Chemistry is such a huge part of baseball, and you now have such a large number of players who have represented the Marlins that we don't know who should be a Marlin and who shouldn't be, even if they're doing well.
Well, I think there'll be some of the players will have like union rules behind them where they, you know, if they've been around long enough, they won't be able to be sent down. But that's a great point. I mean, this is, to me, if I'm running this team, we're having the kind of season, if you're hot, you're hot. You keep going, you know, next man up. I mean, if these guys are winning, like a Marlins team hasn't won, and as long as we can remember, how do you take them out of the lineup? You really can't. It's going to be very, first of all, they're having a great run right now, but we know how this works, Josh.
Yeah.
Baseball is a game of averages. They're going to come down a little bit. But if
regression
for some
to
reason,
the mean. Yeah,
this is how sure. It works. We've seen this show before. But if for some reason they're able to keep pulling off these incredible, miraculous victories, stacking them up 5 in a row at one point, I think they will have to keep some of these guys in the squad.
Yeah, but as Gouldie pointed out, it's your top 3 pitchers. You can't just there's always this credo in baseball, like you don't lose the closer job because you go on the DL and you come back and you got to give it back to that player. You know, where do you make that determination?
Look, your top 3 players, pitchers are pitchers for the Marlins who were slated to finish dead last. I don't care if they're the top 3 players. If they're winning, they're staying. That fan base hasn't had a sniff. They've been treated like garbage for as long as the franchise has been around, last 2 seasons. If they're winning, you keep them in the lineup. That's how it's got to be.
Guys, how big a hat are you tipping towards the manager, Don Mattingly? Because I love the quote when they finally got out of lockdown and they were out of the hotel. You know, he talked about we're just happy to be out. And then he said with total sincerity, and I quote, "We expect to win. Honestly, it will be a different look, but I think we expect to win." I love that. I love the confidence he's injected into this ragtail of players.
Yeah, I mean, just as David said, his quote was, "Some of these guys I've never met." So I don't know how much credit he could get for sending people onto the field that he doesn't even know. I think it's one of those situations where, and David referenced this, right? We regress to the mean, but any guy who's made it to the major leagues can have a good short run. And if you get a handful of them at the same time, you can go on a 5-game tear against the best teams in the league. And keep in mind, they weren't necessarily, they won, I think, the first 4 games of their 5-game run against the Baltimore Orioles. So it wasn't like they were playing a top team. So I think it's exciting. I think it's fun. I think it's been a nice quirk and a feel-good story in an otherwise pretty dark season, but I'm not convinced it's going to be anything more than that.
Is that the same Baltimore Orioles, JC, that are second in the AL East?
Yeah, that speaks more to the AL East than anything else, Goldie.
Doesn't it?
After the Yankees and who?
And who? What's happened to you? Alrighty. That sucks.
Real quick, let's just give Mattingly a little bit of credit. There's a lot of professionalism to keep. The world is falling down around you. He's still got to go in there and address that team and keep things organized and keep going. I think he's done has a really steady hand in keeping everybody cool and calm.
Well played, Don.
There we go. Yeah, so here's the two things he did as well, actually, is Humberto Mejia. He's called him up out of single A ball this week. He never played above single A. Major league debut, gets six strikeouts. How about that?
So that's going, for people who might not know that, that's going three levels. There's double A, triple A, and then the major leagues. He's probably playing high
A
ball.
What a story.
Three levels of A ball.
It's a great story anyway, you slice it. I mean, baseball needs stuff like this.
They're going to make a movie out of this, guys.
It's called Major League.
Not if they finish the season 7-53.
No, they'll make a story. And I'll be playing Derek Jeter.
Here's the thing. The poor guy, there's another guy who pitched the other day as well, the very next day after Humberto Mejia, was Daniel Castano, who never played above double A. So, you know, of course, he has to, like, curse Humberto Mejia, saying, oh, thanks, you just, you know, stole my thunder for being a single A guy. But anyways, moving on. Because we are going on to a very – this is where – don't forget, this is a family show. We're going to try to keep David from swearing here, because this segment is to be called What Bugs Dave, and particularly those not-so-amazing Mets.
Well, what specifically? Because when you talk about the Mets, you're talking about an 8-55-part saga. Which part of the saga would you like to address?
Let's start this week with Yoenis Cespedes and that whole situation.
Great. Thank you. I'm glad you asked about Cespedes. So I go on vacation, and I get out of the car, and I walk out, and my father's there. I haven't seen him in months, by the way, because of COVID. What does he say? Cespedes is missing. What do you mean he's missing? He's like 6'2". Yeah, how can you misplace a 6'2" left fielder DH? So I was naturally very surprised, but not surprised at how this all went down. Of course, Yoenis Cespedes decided to opt out from playing the rest of the 2020 season. But when he left, apparently he did not tell anybody, and that sent Mets management over to his hotel room to find an empty room with nothing in it, no Cespedes, not under a pillow, not in the closet, not in the minibar fridge. He was gone. And they mishandled it, of course, communicating to the press as they do, because they're the Mets. The Mets, you may know, are run like a small family-run zipper factory, and have been for a very long time. And the Cespedes situation is compounded by the fact that the agent who negotiated his initial contract, Brody Van Wagenen, is the general manager of the New York Mets, and the very same general manager who negotiated the settlement after Yoenis Cespedes suffered a season-ending ankle injury on his ranch, which resulted in like a series of back and forth about how much money he should lose in his contract. Conflict of interest, of course. And that leads us to the other question, is why do the Mets have a former player's agent as their general manager? Just the latest New York Mets science experiment, which is all their fans need, is just another baseball science experiment. So that's where we are right now.
Well, you must be excited because it looks like some ownership might be in the form of A-Rod and J-Lo. You, being a Mets fan, must be excited about having a Yankee legend.
Someone just dangled red meat in front of David Langell.
Some people like the idea of A-Rod and J-Lo being owners of the New York Mets. Of course, A-Rod was on his way to becoming a New York Met when the whole 24+1 controversy started. He was close to signing, and then mysteriously these demands started floating in. Whether or not they were true or not, we'll never know. That A-Rod needed an autograph tent at spring training and all kinds of special treatment, maybe on the road, et cetera, et cetera. So he never became a Met. He went to Texas. He went and became a Yankee. If you're a Mets fan, I think for me, the last thing you want is another show in ownership. Can we keep the show on the field, please? I don't want to hear about A-Rod and J-Lo all the time. I want an owner whose name I don't know, who I don't even know what he looks like after all this, after all this drama, after Bernie Madoff, after mishap, after mishap, after misstep, after misstep. It would be very nice to have some steady ownership who just kind of slip into the background and write some very big checks.
Steve, can I ask a question here? Buddy, you're a trained lawyer. you know the legal process. Brody Van Wangenen, we're talking about, that was a former agent and was of Cespedes, now, of course, the GM with the Mets. It, no longer a lawyer, but legally remains a fiduciary for his former clients. And my understanding of the law is that basically he owes a continuing duty to a former client. So him throwing him under the bus, is that potentially illegal, what he's done?
No, I mean, I think that there is a attenuated piece once you've stopped representing a player to the extent of fiduciary duty. But I think it's a broader issue that you're touching on, Gouldy, that's very legitimate, which is whether agents should make the move into front offices. Dave Stewart did it with the Arizona Diamondbacks previously. And along with Cespedes, you have Van Wagenen, who also represented Jacob deGrom, Todd Frazier, Noah Syndergaard, and Tim Tebow. So, I mean, the relationships are way too intertwined, and I'm not a huge Scott Boras fan, who is the Uber agent. But I think he's right on this. As someone who represented players for 9 years myself, I know that once you make that commitment to a player, it needs to be ironclad regardless of what the law is. And it's really impossible to then go onto the other side and do fair dealing. It's the phraseology you use in the legal profession is it's not arm's length anymore. You clearly have a too close a relationship in order for it to be done in any way that is, you know, reasonable on either side. Beyond that, the ethos for an agent is to protect the players at all costs. I mean, your job is to go to war for your clients. And once you go to the other side, you can't just flip that off. And if you do flip that off, then who's going to trust you anyway? So I see a lot of problems with that type of transition.
And he had to do that with Cespedes when renegotiating his contract after Cespedes hurt himself on the ranch. He negotiated the contract, then he had to go back and figure out what penalties he would be taking for taking unfair risks on his contract. Meanwhile, the Mets could have had Chaim Bloom, who is a very well-respected MLB executive who was trained under Andrew Friedman, who was the current general manager, president of the Los Angeles Dodgers. They could have had him, but instead they go into this minefield with Brody Van Wagenen, who proceeds to go trade their biggest prospect that they have for, you know, a box of popcorn and some chewing gum.
Dave, I've got to ask.
That's good chewing gum, though, Dave.
I've got to ask, Dave, just as a Mets fan, for your thoughts, though, in terms of why. I mean, the Cespedes camp are now saying he's opted out due to a family member's pre-existing medical condition. There's conflicting stories as to whether he did tell the club or didn't. The mere fact that the manager didn't know until about the 8th, I think it was, or Luis Rojas has said he had no clue until almost the end of the game that he was meant to be playing in. There's a whole issue of his contract, $7.41 million. A lot of it is performance related. He wasn't happy because he was sitting out the odd game, which was going to make it tough for him to make the full money. The fact is, he had, I think it was a 161 batting average at the time as well. So there's lots of ingredients here for a bit of a who says who does. What's your thoughts? As a Mets fan, who's at fault?
Well, I think obviously Cespedes could have probably handled it better, but at the same time, we're dealing with a very short timeline. It's not really up to Cespedes. It's up to Cespedes' agent to go and inform. You know, Cespedes doesn't conduct the kind of business of the player. His agent does. And we don't know what the timeline and what happened. Perhaps, it's a Sunday. I think it was a Sunday or it was a Saturday. It was over the weekend. And they're trying to get in touch. Maybe they couldn't get in. Maybe he couldn't get in touch with his agent, so on and so forth. Could Cespedes have done a little bit more? Of course. But you have to say what happened. An organization of folly leaves itself open to things like this happening. If you're a buttoned up organization, this doesn't happen, I would imagine.
Well, it's also worth pointing out that TMZ released pictures of Cespedes just a few days before opting out for COVID, salsa dancing out at
100%.
A club.
He wants the money. I predicted Cespedes having a monster year this season, because we know he had an incentive-laden contract, and that guy already had millions. He was supposed to make $30 million before the year started. That was trimmed, cut, massive haircut on that deal. And he needed to really perform this year to get that money, and he needed to be in the lineup. And I am surprised that he didn't give himself more of an opportunity to take that money off the table, to be honest. But I also think that the Mets are in fault for general communications problems, which we've seen over the years, and this is just the latest.
I'm amazed we went through that round without any profanity. That was well done, David.
We're professional. Thank you.
Moving on, because now we're going to discuss about haunted houses, or in this case, a haunted hotel in particular.
Yeah, so this is our changeup. We've done our three pitches, and now we sort of mix it up with a little bit of a quirky baseball story. And I saw this on Twitter. Trevor Plouffe, who was a former major leaguer, played for the Twins, among other teams, had this really interesting tweet that required me to do a little research, although without spoiler alert, David knows a lot about this. He said, quote, "Prayers to the Cardinals for having to stay in that haunted ass hotel in Milwaukee for so long." Now, the Cards were stuck in Milwaukee after all the COVID positive tests, and I did a little research, and that hotel is the Pfister Hotel. But what I didn't realize was how renowned it is as being a haunted hotel. And David Lengel has actually stayed at this hotel, so I'm going to hand it over to him for a first-person account.
First of all, it's a beautiful hotel. A lot of detail.
Ghost-like, ghosts have taste.
It's gorgeous. I highly suggest if you're ever in Milwaukee that you stay at the Pfister Hotel. But I learned about this actually while I was there, and I was surprised to learn that this is going back decades, Josh. I mean, this is not new. When I went to bed that night, I have expected to see like Babe Ruth flying around in my dreams, or
eating hot dogs,
or invading the mini bar. That's the second time I've mentioned mini bar on this podcast. If you're playing at home,
drinking game.
It didn't happen for me, but I did hear a story about a bunch of St. Louis Cardinals a few years back. That they were all three of them in separate rooms, and they each got so scared they decided to sleep together so that they could attack the ghost as a unit. Should the ghost
Ghostbusters don't cross the streams?
And you know, this is really happening. And if you thought Milwaukee was a kind of strange destination to play ball in, it gets even stranger when you check into the Pfister Hotel.
I think it's from having one too many brats. Because, you know, that's Milwaukee. My favorite story was from Bryce Harper in 2012, who said, quote, "I laid a pair of jeans and a shirt on that table at the foot of the bed. When I woke up in the morning, I swear on everything, the clothes were on the floor and the table on the opposite side of the room." Gouldy, do you have a few of those stories too?
Oh, Jesse, my absolute favorite, and I did like the Bryce Harper one, was 2016, Yi Man Choi. Is that right?
Yep.
Choi,
yep.
Right. Another future brewer. He was an Angel first baseman at the time. And he reported, and I quote, "feeling the presence of a spirit in his bed." Yeah, you man, it was a spirit in your bed. That's a great cover story. Michael Young, and this is the one that really sticks out for me, because, of course, we met Michael Young. Do you remember on the
great
road trip?
Guy.
Top
great
boy
with
the Rangers at the time. Lovely, lovely man. And he was talking about an experience in 2011, saying he was lying in bed after a night game, and he said, "My room was locked, but I heard footsteps inside my room stomping around," which is pretty damn scary. So what did he do? He stood up, turned all the lights on, and basically shouted and said, "Look, it's fine. If you guys want to be here, that's okay, you know, but don't open the door, don't make a noise, and don't wake me up." Switched the light off, got back into bed, had a great night's sleep. There was no more noise. So
very
I love the attitude. He took it on the chin and said, you know, it's fine, but I'm not going to be scared. But for God's sake, don't keep waking me up with all the noise. Love it.
All right, so we got to end this by asking each of us, do you believe in ghosts? Are you buying or selling on this?
Yeah, I do. I do. Yeah, no, I do. I do.
Why not? I'll take a ghost.
No, ooh. I don't feel no ghosts.
Yeah, I don't believe in no ghosts either.
Nice.
Oh, so you're wrong.
Casper was a friendly ghost. He's fine.
Zool. Now, moving on, because we've now reached the point of an interview with a certain somebody that Johnny will take us through.
This one's a bit special. The official MLB field consultant and head groundskeeper is a guy by the name of Murray Cook. Very important man. I know from my personal experience, the groundsman rules the roost. There's no baseball without Murray's say-so. He oversaw the London series, did a great job, Red Sox Yankees last year, and he was also part of the preparation for the Iowa Field of Dreams matchup, which tragically was cancelled this week. Their loss was our gain, because JC caught up with Murray Cook.
So it's with great pleasure that I welcome Murray Cook, who is MLB's official field and stadium consultant, to the Johnny and Josh Show. Murray, thank you so much for coming on.
Good to be with you.
It is truly a pleasure, because I know, but many of our listeners don't know exactly what a huge role you play in baseball development, both as it relates to Major League Baseball and the world in general. And just to give a little bit of your background, you've been working in this field of designing, constructing, and cultivating baseball fields across the world for more than 30 years. You've worked in 60 plus countries. And as it comes to some of the major events, whether we're talking about the Olympics or the World Baseball Classic or MLB events like the great Fort Bragg game that occurred in 2016, or for many of our listeners, they might not know, you were essential in making the 2019 London Series occur. You're at the center of that process. Can you just talk a little bit about what you do to make these fields happen?
Well, it's been through a lot of trial and error and working through a lot of different plans over the many years. We've had we've worked at a lot of temporary ballparks. You know, obviously Sydney in 2014, and played a lot of different unique places around the world. I think one of the cool places we went to was in Regensburg, back for the WBC qualifier, where we kind of made that ballpark work for that major event. But it's been an evolution of taking the game to cool and new places around the world, and now obviously domestically in the U.S. too, has been kind of the vision of MLB to continue growing the game in places where people can't see the game. I think it's a great thing.
Now, I just heard the beeping behind you, and the reason for that is you are currently in Dyersville, Iowa, which is the location for any baseball fan would know of the Field of Dreams field, the great cornfield. And you unfortunately are in the news for sort of sad reasons, and I'm going to totally butcher this. You know, you built it, but unfortunately people are not coming. There was meant to be a Field of Dreams game, major league game, between the White Sox and the Cardinals later this season. It was canceled. Talk about that. It must be heartbreaking for you.
It really is. I mean, it's unfortunate for the people in Iowa. It's the first game that would have been played in Iowa, first major league game. It's unfortunate for the fans, for the players, for baseball as a whole, because, you know, the movie really touched a lot of folks, you know, since it came out in 89, and when we announced it back in August, it just everyone, you know, kind of has a connection to the movie. And working here in Dyersville, you know, being here now for the past year on and off, but the past few months building the ballpark up, and the game would be a week from today. It's just unfortunate it had to be pulled down, but we're it's like the movie. We're hoping and planning that we'll play again next year here, and that hasn't been confirmed. And so, you know, the field is ready, the ballpark is ready to go, and yeah, unfortunately, we had to shut it down.
Now, this is one of the, probably the most unique. Yeah, I hear it's being shut down right behind you.
Yes,
now, this must be the most unique ballpark that you've ever put together. I saw some of the time-lapse photography, and you actually built out additional corn stalks, a cornfield behind the field, different from the cornfield that occurred in the field that was used in the movie, correct?
Yes, that's correct. This was very unique, similar to Fort Bragg, but the fact that it is in the middle of a cornfield. We originally looked to build the field and use the original movie site field, but because of the location of it next to the house, and also the field itself had some really rough grading that we would have to do and really rebuild that field totally. They didn't want to mess with the historical components of that, so we looked a little bit farther to the west, about 150 yards, and that's where we built our field. And there we had to do quite a bit of grading. We had to move like 30,000 cubic yards of soil to get a level, and it turned out really beautiful. We're really, really pleased with it. Again, you know, it's sad about this pandemic that we're in, and, you know, and this game was really kind of built around the whole, you know, hope, because, you know, hope is part of trying to you hope the pandemic is over, you hope we get a vaccine, we hope for this game, and baseball was trying to be a big part of that here. And you know what? That's just the way it works. We'll pack it up here as we're doing now in the next couple of weeks. The field will remain, and we'll just bring it all out sometime next year once they determine if that's going to happen or not, for sure.
Now, I want to bring you back to last year in the London Series. A lot of our listeners, of course, attended that event. That was a place where you built it, and people really did come. How was that experience? I mean, you were going into a very well-constructed stadium, but not one that was prepared for baseball, which is something you had done many times before. But were there certain efforts and difficulties with this particular stadium, with the London Stadium, that you had to overcome?
Well, I think it was the timeline, right? I mean, we had 21 days to build this ballpark. So it took a tremendous amount of planning. And you know, I tip my hat to all the folks here who helped us in London, the UK. Just a tremendous amount of help with Ryan and the Hewitts family who helped us build it. You know, we spent probably, 2 years planning because of all the different components to stage and ensure he goes in and goes out and comes out within the week right afterwards so they can get ready for the West Ham soccer. I think that was probably the biggest challenge for us.
One of the things I loved about your ground crew is that you brought in people who were local and who were involved with the baseball community in Great Britain. And I know that it meant so much for them to be involved in the process. And that was something that was a really nice touch.
It really was. I mean, I had the entire ground crew, our TARP crew, all of them from the Baseball UK softball program, the girls and the guys that helped us there for the week, they were just tremendous. And then we brought some other guys in from other parts of the country of Europe. We brought Hank down from Amsterdam and Hoofddorp Ballpark. We try to engage that because it's leaving behind some education, being part of that is something that we'll remember forever. And I've been fortunate to be a part of a lot of these. And I just know how important it is to get the local community and the folks involved to building these. That worked out well.
Were you surprised with how the field played? I mean, obviously it was a real offensive explosion. To what extent was that the stadium, the field, the design, to what extent was that just the way the games played out?
You know what, we've batted that around, literally batted that around as they did in London multiple times. I mean, it was just one of those two games that there was just an explosive amount of power, which the people in obviously UK loved it, and enjoyed the fireworks that came with it. You know, overall, field played great. You know, we had great hops. The day before the workout, Tanaka was out there, pitched off the mound. He said, "This is the best mound I've ever pitched off of." The next day, he gets, rocked 6 runs in the first inning. You know, so we spent a lot of time trying to mimic and design and ensure that we had a good, consistent playing field. We're pleased with how that turned out.
Now, you went with artificial turf, and one of the things I've been hearing from some of my European baseball connections is that turf may actually end up staying in Europe, and that there's some discussion now that a club may, it's unclear which one, but a club may end up getting that turf if they're willing to come and pick it up. Is that going to happen? Is it going to stay the solid ground?
Yeah, I've heard bits and pieces of that story. I don't know all the details and confirmations for sure what's happening, but I do know it's staying in Europe. We look to bring it back. We brought back, in fact, here in Dyersville, if we'd have played the game, which we will next year, as they're planning to do, we brought a lot of equipment back over here for this event. So the bat boxes and all the dugout benches that were in that we were going to use this year for the Cardinals game and Cubs game in London are here in Dyersville. So the Cardinals still would have had a little piece of London where they played on. In fact, we put the home plate in that we were going to put in London for this series. We anchored it here in Dyersville. So that home plate has been around the world.
So one question European fans have, and I don't know whether you have the answer to it or would tell me even if you did, but whether the games that were meant to occur this summer in London again, which were canceled, whether they're going to happen in the future or whether there's going to be another European site. Have you gotten any directive as to what you might be doing as it relates
to
that?
We have had no inclination as to what the future, comes about for us next year. We know it's going to be a lean year internationally. Obviously, the WBC follows up the following year is what I understand. So, that'll be the qualifiers in the WBC. Next year is an Olympic year. So we have some Olympic qualifiers yet to play for here in the U.S. and in Asia. But outside of that, as far as any international planning, European-wise, I really haven't heard very much at all.
One thing we talk about in Great Britain and all throughout Europe often is just the desire and the need to have good facilities, to bring it full circle to Field of Dreams. If you build it, you know, the movie says he will come, but they will come. To what extent are you seeing Europe finally reach some sort of, maybe not a pinnacle, but at a reasonable level for facilities? And specific to Great Britain, do they need more facilities? At, you know, is Farnham Park enough? Do they really need more facilities in order to see the level of baseball grow in Great Britain, similar to maybe some other European countries?
Yeah, I think, you know, part of playing a game, whether it be softball or baseball, we look to have fields. And when you're having to share fields with soccer and that they're not the same, you know, you don't have an infield, you're having to throw down your bases, you have to do all these temporary things. It, you know, you can't build that consistency in play. And once you have facilities that are designed for the sport, you know, I've seen the growth since, you know, back 20, well, we played in Bonn, we played some games there and, you know, brought over the MLB alumni and played in Frankfurt back early 2000, I think it was. And, you know, that kind of was just planting these seeds around, you know, Europe to, here's what this game is about. And since then, you've got, you know, this great, tremendous facility there in Regensburg. You got the one up in Amsterdam. You've got the Farnham Park there in the UK. And, you know, the development of the sport really has to follow fields, you know, in our estimation, because that means you're committed to play. When you're having to share, it's like, well, we're kind of using both. I mean, it works, but it's not really saying, okay, we're going to get out here and really develop a program. And the folks that are developing these programs that are really raising their game have these facilities.
For sure. Murray, I can't thank you enough. Murray Cook, of course, MLB's official field and stadium consultant. Keep doing the good work. I'm sorry that you're breaking down the field there in Dyersville. Yeah, it's the Field of Dreams. But, you know, hopefully that dream will come back.
Yeah. Same here, Josh. Appreciate you having me on, and hope all's well on your side. And I know you're here, but hope everyone's doing well in the UK.
Great. Thank you so much, Murray.
All right. Thanks, Ben.
So that was Murray Cook, official MLB field consultant and head groundskeeper, speaking with our very own JC. Josh, the first thing I've got to pick up on is slightly worried about that business about the turf and the London series, because that sounds to me that the suggestion is it's not going to happen next year.
Yeah, I have to agree with you, Gouldie. When I heard that the turf was going to be given away, and Murray didn't fully, you know, he neither confirmed nor denied, but seemed to suggest that that is what's happening. That's a, you know, a huge expense and a huge decision to let that go. And I fear that suggests that we're not going to be seeing another game in London anytime soon for Major League Baseball.
And obviously that's an enormous disappointment. We looked forward to having baseball in London for a very long time, and it's a shame that if it is a one-hit wonder. We will mourn that. And I'm also very upset that we're not going to have that game in Iowa. I was looking forward to seeing the White Sox and then the Cardinals play and see how this corn would be and see if I could make it through the game without crying. I couldn't make it through Field of Dreams without crying, obviously. You know, I'm hopeful that that would at least come back. These games are fun. You know, we had these games, and we had some games in a military base. We had now the Field of Dreams game. These are quirky, interesting games that make, you know, the season fun, and it's a shame to lose them.
For sure. I loved Murray talking about growing the corn stalks behind the field. And I had done research for one of the books I had written about the growing of the corn for the actual Field of Dreams movie. And there was a huge drought that year when they were filming the movie, and the corn was not growing to the height it needed to grow to, right? Because Kevin Costner had to sort of walk through it. Obviously, the players had to come out. And so they ended up diverting a ton of water in order to create this effectively faux cornfield where there were actually real farmers who were herding. And Kevin Costner said that he felt tremendous guilt about doing that. So the ghosts, this is a ghost themed clearly episode, and maybe the ghosts are now haunting the people who made Field of Dreams.
I think it's time for the seventh inning stretch.
Now, I guess through osmosis, we'll just pretty much just throw away willy-nilly that the baseball movie of the week, if you haven't seen it yet, what's wrong with you? is Field of Dreams. It's just apropos that we just discussed Field of Dreams very briefly, that it is, I guess, one of those, when with this kind of stuff that we do every week in our podcast, I try not to pick the obvious films that everyone's seen or everyone's heard about.
Eric.
Yes.
Never seen it from start to finish. Keep That's coming in the middle.
This is a mess.
Never wow. seen it from start to finish.
Are you kidding?
Jesus.
My name is Johnny Gould. This is. I'm getting this off my chest. I've never
Johnny,
seen it.
Johnny, get out. Get out of the square.
Oh, my God.
I'm sorry.
Can I be honest, though? I think it's a little overrated.
So I agree.
Okay, you know what? Yes, but required viewing. It's yeah. quotable. It's
part of the canon. It's part overrated? Of the canon. It was too treacly. Ray Liotta is shoeless jokes.
Yeah.
Well, Kevin Costner's performance in Waterworld is maybe just a little bit better.
The thing is, it comes right around the same time as Bull Durham, which is, in my opinion, the greatest baseball.
Absolutely,
movie
JC, I cannot agree with you more. Number one.
All right.
So you know, when you have these two films at the same time, you can't help but weigh each other against themselves, and one is vastly better than the other.
Anyway, so it would have been a mistake for me not to say Field of
I
Dreams
disagree.
During this week. Oh, well, you disagree.
David,
oh,
yeah. Was that you or your mustache talking?
No, my mustache disagrees, and everything behind it disagrees. Field of Dreams made me cry. Field of Dreams, you know what? My favorite shot of Field of Dreams is when they're in Fenway. And it has, you know, I think they shot it. They may have shot it during an actual game, I'm not sure. But it had this wonderful haze in the shot. And I'm saying, that haze just reminds you of sitting in a ballpark in summer and time sort of just stands still. I love that shot. I'll always remember that shot. But on top of that, the story is fun.
You're saying it's better than Bull Durham, which speaks more to the religion of baseball.
It's different. It's different. You know, so is Bull Durham more of a fun baseball? First of all, Bull Durham is definitely something that captures the spirit. The minor leagues, the whole trudging through, et cetera. But Field of Dreams speaks to the romance of the game that we like to think exists when we know it's just a business.
Romance?
And, you know, it pulls us back in.
David! Kevin what? Costner and Susan Sarandon not being romance.
Well, not that,
that
kind of romance.
Tim Robbins.
Not that kind of romance.
Get the waffle, Eric.
That's enough now. That's enough. Anyways, yes, Bull Durham and Field of Dreams. It's like when you go to a ballpark. Do you want a hot dog or do you want an ice cream sundae? There's space for both. Okay, so now moving along. Eric's baseball book of the week.
Come on, JC.
Is it my week?
It is Brit at a ballpark. It is British related.
It's not.
Not even. You're choosing other British baseball books. Hurtful.
I'm choosing ones that people have heard of. Now, the
wow,
Brit at the Ballpark, written by Peter Taylor, who was actually
we're mentioned in the book.
Big fan of the show.
And yeah, the thing is, everybody in this podcast is mentioned in this book. So hence why we're plugging it.
That's why it's the greatest book of all time.
Which
was the one that Gouldy wrote the foreword to, though? I mean, you didn't at least go for that one. You're not just putting me down, you're putting Gouldy down too.
Yes,
that might
right.
come next. Now, Peter Taylor
wrote Gouldy's forward.
The fascinating thing about this book, for any British baseball fan, you don't even have to be British. You don't even have to be a baseball fan. He had the epiphany to actually go to all 50 states in one season and see a baseball game, whether it was minor league, whether it was major league, whether it was Iowa.
Minor league team in Alaska?
He went to Hawaii.
Summer League, I know.
And he went to Iowa and visited that actual farm and saw a little game there, that little exhibition game there at the Field of Dreams cornfield.
Quick add-on to that, though, Eric, which is that if you want to follow someone on social media who did the exact same thing and who's a great follower, he's probably the British fan who's most followed at Baseball Brit. Joey Mellows did a very similar type of trip last year, and he is a great follow.
Now, here's the thing.
I follow.
Peter Taylor, when he approached Cooperstown and gave the evidence that he did this, Cooperstown came back to him and said, listen, we can't find anyone else who's done this before, but we're not saying that no one else has or hasn't done this before, but we will recognize that you have done this. So Peter Taylor is in the archives at Cooperstown for doing his 50 states in 7 months, and
he made it to Cooperstown.
And made it to Cooperstown, which is one day we will be. Doesn't have the brown plaque though, but that's pretty
Peter
much
Peter Taylor, Vince Scully, Babe Ruth.
There you go. Now,
the big three, we call them.
Moving on. Moving on, we discussed TV references in pop culture regarding baseball. Last week, we discussed Curb Your Enthusiasm, a classic episode where Bill Buckner was in it. But I was alerted by many of our loyal listeners about another Curb Your Enthusiasm episode, and Netflix has recently done a documentary about how a person's life was saved by going to a Dodgers game and how an episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm saved him from the electric chair. And it's called Long Shot. I thoroughly recommend it. It's only 40 minutes long. It's on
there. I've heard this story.
Yeah, I know this story as well, too. That yeah. They went fantastic. Back to footage.
They made a documentary. The
guy was no spoilers. No spoilers. You see Long Shot on Netflix. Basically, the episode in question of Curb Your Enthusiasm is when Larry David is late for a Dodgers game. He's trying to rush to get a Dodger Stadium. So he picks up a prostitute just in the carpool lane in Los Angeles.
Gould's done that.
To get to Dodgers Stadium. I think
Hugh Grant
that,
Johnny right? Gould, you know.
I'm going to a Dodger game. Exactly. So basically two references there. If you can find that episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm where he goes in the carpool lane with the prostitute to get to the Dodger game, it's hilarious. But on top of that, then you got to see Long Shot on Netflix where it all intertwines, and there you go. Now, moving on to the trivia question answer. Or the answer to the trivia question. There we go. I asked you before, to reiterate what the question was, which member of the 2008 bronze medal U.S. Olympic team went on to become a World Series MVP in Major League Baseball? Now, there's quite a few kind candidates in that team. If you actually look on that team, it's a pretty impressive lineup who eventually, you know, went on to become famous. And can any of you tell me who became a World Series MVP from that Olympic bronze medal team?
Can I go first?
Sure.
No clue. Thank you.
You came out strong, Gouldie.
I did.
As always.
The old college try, Johnny.
Leave him hanging.
So the player who was the biggest pitching star on that team had pitched at San Diego State was Steven Strasburg. So
right.
I believe he was MVP of – wasn't he? I mean, he won a World Series last year.
Now, David, are you going to hazard a guess yourself?
This is a very, very tough question, Eric. You really, you know, you didn't even cheat and give us the answers, which you usually do. I appreciate that. Next time.
Speak for yourself, David.
But how about he may be a little too old just thinking about recent MVPs. How about Steve Pierce?
Right. Okay. Interesting. That's now.
Interesting. May have been a little too old.
Now, here's the
He just retired. I don't know if he played. Oh, wait.
On that bronze medal team, you had Jake Arrieta, who went on to win the NL Cy Young Award, but not World Series MVP. And that player was, yes, indeed, Steven Strasburg, last year's Nationals World Series MVP. And there he goes.
He was such a star coming out of college. Do you remember that, Dave? I mean, absolutely, all of us should remember that.
Well, Harper. Yeah, I got Harper, and then they got Strasburg. And they
should have been in an expo.
Then they didn't win until Harper left.
Chemistry matters.
Exactly. And just case in point that how, you know, Olympic programs really can, I mean, yes, I know it's easier for an American, but having baseball in the Olympic program is, you know, it's pretty much essential if you want to sort of excel, if you're, you know, from another country kind of thing. It helps 100%. The profile. And now we got to wait till Tokyo 2021 for the, if it happens, hopefully it will happen, for baseball back in the Olympics.
Well, it should be in there over rugby. Let's just say that, right, Johnny?
We get into this debate. Have we got time very quickly?
No.
We do not.
Now, let's move on.
Put a pin in that one, Jules.
Let's move on. So,
put a pin in that one.
I believe the question.
Let's throw the question to the listeners. What's your definition of an Olympic sport? I'm interested to hear what people say.
Oh, this again.
All I know is that curling is on the permanent program for the winter. Hey,
and I like curling as an Olympic sport.
All hail curling.
I want to see my friend in the Olympics.
Apparently, the postman has been Johnny, or the electric postman has been. You have the mailbag from our viewers.
I have to, indeed, buddy. And huge thanks to everybody that keeps getting in touch. I'll pick a few out. Don't forget, it's the Johnny and Josh Show on Facebook, and it's at Johnny and Josh on Twitter, on Instagram. We do want to hear from you. I mean, you know, talk to us about your movies, your books. I mean, tell us that Eric doesn't know what he's talking about. We want to hear, not just a straightforward question, guys. We just want to hear from you, and we'll obviously do our very level best. This is your show. Get involved. Be a part of it. So, guys, what I'm going to do this week, just to keep it nice and tight, is I'll ask one of you specifically to answer, and unless somebody's got something that's real value added, don't add in. Okay, so first up, knuckleball. Ian J. Smith, just wondering, JC, this is for you, what your opinion on the knuckleball picture is. Is this a dying art, or are there some good projects coming through? And Ian J. Smith, just like me, massive fan of Tim Wakefield. We all remember Tim Wakefield, the knuckleballer. What's your thoughts, JC? Are there any knuckleballers of Tim Wakefield's caliber still out there?
I mean, not at the moment, but it's one of those type of pitches that ebbs and flows. You just have to get the right person who can then be tutored by a Tim Wakefield or an R.A. Dickey or someone who's done it previously. I actually own a book called The Knuckle Book, because at one point near the end of my career, I was like, can I figure out how to do it? And what I learned from the book is that no one can teach you unless you have a feel for it. No matter how hard I tried to do it, never even came close to being good at throwing a knuckleball. It is a unique pitch, and so it's not something that you can just sort of create a pipeline for. You have to find the right person.
I always thought if I ever won the lottery, I would hire Gaylord Perry or a knuckleball pitcher. Just come to my house every day. We're gonna go knuckleball, and then I'll make the majors.
And what would you pay him?
For some reason.
How much would you pay?
It would be the ultimate sunk cost, Dave. I'm telling you, it's one of those things where it can't be taught unless you have an innate skill for it. You're taught on the margins on how to control it, but unless you can actually throw it in the first place, it's...
And Dave, when JCC says an innate skill, it means talent in sports, so there's absolutely no point in you doing that. Question number two, and this one's for you, Dave. David, this one's for you.
Table tennis.
This is from Michael Sprake. The Cards and Cubs series postponed because obviously of the Cardinals' COVID situation, the game between the White Sox and the Indians will replace it on Sunday Night Baseball. The White Sox will be appearing on Sunday Night Baseball, and this is unbelievable, for the first time in over 7 years. It is a great matchup, particularly a pitching matchup, because we've got 2019 All-Stars, Giolito, of course, going, and Bieber on the mound. What's your thoughts? Why are the White Sox not getting any love from Sunday Night Baseball?
Well, because they've been horrible, and ESPN is in the business of making money, and they want teams who have main attractions. But the good news for White Sox fans who would like to see their team get more national attention is that they are coming on and coming on strong, and they have Luis Robert, who's going crazy. At one point, he had an OPS of over 1,000, and he's been kind of coming back to earth little by little by little, but he's an incredible Cuban-born prospect who had a slugging percentage in single A ball at one point of 1.4 something.
So, wow.
Needless to say, he was promoted quite quickly last year. He started off in single A ball last year, and he made it all the way through to triple A, and now he's come on like gangbusters, and it's very, very exciting for baseball fans and White Sox fans to have a player of that caliber making noise.
Oh, well, one more. There's a Daniel Salmon message there, Johnny. And regarding a topic that you like, fantasy baseball.
Daniel Fish, do you mean, when you say Daniel Salmon?
Yes, sorry. Actually, it's...
Apologies to Daniel. Yes, he mentions, and I'm loving this, Daniel. Guys, for those of you listening in for the first time, we're also doing an add-on fantasy baseball podcast. I get to chat with my good mate, James Holden, who's a phenomenal player. And Daniel very kindly has messaged in, Saturday morning, you recommend, or at least James did, Mike
Yastrzemski. That's embarrassing. His grandfather was Carl Yastrzemski.
Yeah, Hall of Famer. You may have heard of him. He won the
I've heard of him. Yeah, I just can't pronounce him. He said, you recommend picking up Mike as a fantasy player to try and grab. And then he goes, Saturday night, he homers off Clayton Kershaw. Great tip. Cheers. Our pleasure, Daniel. We are here to serve. Do check
good old
out.
Daniel Haddock.
Yes, along
Daniel. With two other giants.
Daniel Fish, Daniel Salmon, Daniel Trout.
Oh, my God, enough.
What is
there
so
was
fun
Mike
about
Carp.
Mike?
There was Mike Carp. Remember him?
Mike Trout. Right? Can that be another? Can this be another discussion?
Okay, moving on. One more email. One more.
Okay, well, this one, okay, if we've only got time for one more, I'm going to go with Ollie Bishop. Ollie's asked the question, and I'll ask all three of you. best game you've ever been to? For him, it was Randy Johnson's perfect game at the TED in 2004. Wow, that must have been amazing to be at, Ollie. Guys, any thoughts? Best game you've ever been at?
Game four of the 2004 World Series when the Red Sox broke the curse.
And you were there?
Yeah, I was broadcasting it for the
Of course
the
you were. In 2004, so you were.
Yeah.
Eric?
A bunch of Expos games.
Way to be so surgical with your answer, Eric.
Exactly.
Once again, I
remember the poutine and the steamed hot dogs with the toasted buns. But who's that from? Ollie Cardinal?
That's from, Ollie Bishop, mate.
But must be a St. Louis fan, right?
Dave, how about you? Favorite game?
Well, it was the best game I've ever been to and the worst game I've ever been to. 2006 NLCS Game 7, the best because Andy Chavez made that catch, which was so special to save the game at the time, at least, for the Mets. And then, of course, they went on to blow it. Check swing, Carlos Beltran, Wainwright on the hill. And so that made it the worst game. So it was a great moment, the greatest moment I've ever seen live, that catch, and then the biggest heartbreak I've ever had at the same time.
Well, guys, if I can offer you my sixpence on this one, I've been spoiled rotten, but I have to say the first game I ever saw, 1997 at the old Baltimore Orioles Stadium. It was a Tuesday night, or Tuesday afternoon, in fact. I think there were literally about 400 people. They were the worst team in baseball. It was the first time I'd ever been, didn't know the rules, nothing's changed. And I went there with my girlfriend's dad, Lefty. Lefty explained the rules to me, and I was just sitting there enjoying the view. It was a terrible game. Don't even remember who the opposition were. But there was this massive guy about 15 rows in front of me, and Lefty just been explaining about the important thing of a foul ball, and he was walking back to his seat with literally a barrel of beer and a barrel of popcorn in either arm, and suddenly a foul ball was hit and it was coming straight at him, and you could see he's looking at the ball going, it's a foul ball, it's coming straight at me, I've got no hands free to catch it. And there was just a moment when time sat still, and suddenly he just said, oh, to hell with it. He dropped both all over the people that were in the row in front of him, and then leapt, despite he weighed about 24 stone, he leapt like a salmon, with the agility of a salmon, to try and get this ball, got his hand out, the ball hit his glove, it dropped out, and some kid ran up, picked the ball and ran away. He stood up, he was covered in beer, pub and popcorn, the cameras panned in on him, and all 400 of us in the stadium got a close-up. He stood up, put his hands above his head, and we cheered him. He got a standing ovation, and that was the day I fell in love with baseball.
My hero.
And we're still paying for that sin every day.
I feel like I saw that scene in Field of Dreams.
It was just amazing. I mean, the commitment for a foul ball. He's lost his barrel of beer and his keg of popcorn, but he didn't care. And we loved him, and we cheered him to the rafters.
Anyway, I love a keg of popcorn.
Yeah, I was trying to think of a
egg stands, popcorn.
Well, I've already used barrel. I wasn't quite sure. Bucket. There you go. Bucket.
Bucket. There we go. Now, move along, because it's it.
Okay, well, that's all we've got time for on the mailbag, I'm afraid, guys. Thanks to Matt and to Marianne and Nigel and Phil, who I didn't get to. But the biggest thank of all to you guys. JC, Eric, what a pleasure, as always, to speak with you guys.
Goldie, fantastic. And of course, our special guest was the Miller Lite MVP.
The very MVP.
Sweet. Very sweet. You're talking about Eric, I guess.
And less filling.
We're talking about you, Big Dave. We love you loads. We're so grateful
you
joined us.
Too, Johnny.
Please promise us you're going to come back as often as you can.
I'll be there with swim shorts on.
You're always the MVP. You're all the MVPs, and our listeners particularly MVPs. Thank you for joining us on the Johnny and Josh Show. Don't forget, subscribe on Facebook. It's Johnny and Josh on Twitter, on Instagram. We want to hear from you. Be part of the family. But the team will be back this time next week. We look forward to having your company. Take good care of yourselves, guys.